Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Telerik. Create compelling app experiences across any screen with the Telerik platform. Telerik's end-to-end platform uniquely combines industry-leading UI tools with cloud services to simplify the entire app development cycle. Telerik offers everything .NET developers need to build quality apps faster. Try it free at telerik.com/platform. That's telerik.com/platform.
From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 454. In this episode, Scott talks with engineer Erica Stanley about the Internet of Things.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today I'm talking with Erica Stanley. She's a technologist and a technology person who knows all about IoT. And this is a buzzword I've been very confused about, the Internet of Things. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So I saw you speak at All Things Open, and you educated a whole room, a standing room only room of people on IoT. And I felt like it's time to talk about that on the show. So I appreciate what you've got to share.
Thanks.
It seems like this is like the new buzzword. Like this is the word. Everyone's like, oh, IoT this and IoT that. Isn't this just plugging small stuff into the internet?
Partly. I mean, and it is very buzzy, right? But there are a lot of technologies that come into this that make this and this interconnected kind of ecosystem that we're slowly creating.
Mm-hmm. And like, I know, Arduino was a thing before IoT became a buzzword.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the kind of the maker movement and a lot of the smaller boards have really made some of the things, we're seeing with IoT possible. So I think that it really kind of furthered this technology and kind of brought it to the consumer space a lot sooner than we may have seen it.
So you're saying was it the connected aspect of it, or was it the maker, movement that brought it to the forefront?
I think it was a little bit of both. It was kind of, you know, the planets aligning with certain, technological aspects of IoT. So you had the maker movement, you had the, a lot of the different connectivities, being more useful, but also developers having access to these things, I think has really furthered this. It's really kind of allowed some innovation in the space that we may not have seen for a few years if we had not had things like Arduino and, you know, and Raspberry Pi.
And it seems like there's two sides from a consumer's perspective. There's all the consumer stuff that I can plug in, like connected refrigerators that I think rich people have, and there's now smart TVs, but also things like Nest. And then there's the developer side, like you said, the maker side of things. So let's talk first about the consumer side. Like, I have a Nest. That would be an IoT device. That's part
absolutely,
of it.
Absolutely. Because it connects and allows you to monitor, you know, remotely and on different connected devices.
Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I have in my house is I have an alarm system through a company called alarm.com. So I can turn my alarm on and off. I haven't been able to get the two to talk to each other. So I don't really get the sense that they're both like open platforms.
Right. And there's some that are more open, right? There's some where they have definitely taken into consideration, the different ways that a user might want to connect. One I like a lot is SmartThings, because they take into consideration a lot of the ways that you'd want your home to be smart. So versus, you know, it's very different, from Nest that controls, you know, temperature and certain things, but does not necessarily connect with other smart devices in your home.
Yeah.
Whereas SmartThings has a platform to allow you to do those things.
This idea of a platform seems to be coming up more and more. Like, I think maybe IoT, manufacturers have realized that if it's not open and a platform that I can build on, that we're probably not going to use it.
Absolutely. And it kind of gets back to mobile maybe 5 years ago when, you know, no one really, started working with different, operating systems until the developers got into it and started building apps and started finding new ways to connect these platforms or to interact with these platforms. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's something of what you're seeing with IoT, because the developers are really kind of pushing this forward.
Yeah. I did see recently that Nest got support for IFTTT, the if this, then that kind of workflow. This is that way to plug devices into other things on the internet, not just devices, but also social. So I made it so if my temperature got too high, like if one of my sons turned the temperature up on the Nest, that it would text me that, hey, it's over 75 degrees in the house. But that doesn't really feel like quite for me that Nest was like an open platform. What does an open platform look like? What should a perfect IoT open platform look like to you?
I would think it's a platform where you can bring your own devices, right? You can bring your own monitoring. You can, you know, if you like, you know, me being a developer myself, you could build a monitoring platform on top of it. So I think that these are, you know, different ways that you can really kind of push this technology and make it, you know, more user driven, more consumer driven.
Mm-hmm. That's why you mentioned SmartThings. I assume that you don't have a relationship with the SmartThings company.
I do not.
But, one of the things that I noticed about them is that SmartThings, you can see at smartthings.com, supports like the Philips Hue connected light bulb and Dropcam and Belkin, which now is getting into power on in this kind of space. They appear to be more about a platform and less about making widgets.
Absolutely.
Do you think that someone who's a consumer who goes to like Home Depot and wants to buy something should be using buying certain things and not others for fear that they might lock themselves in? I don't want to be a vendor locked in with the IoT.
Absolutely. And it's kind of hard right now because right now we're developing in silos. It's very vertical in a lot of ways. So what I would do is just kind of research what you're trying to do, as far as, making a certain aspect of your home or your life, more connected, and then see the different platforms that will allow you to connect and see how you can connect things that you're already using. Do that research before you ever go into a Home Depot so that you know that what you're bringing home is going to be able to be connected to whatever platform you've chosen.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like people like Belkin, they're starting to build their own kind of little, you know, mini platform. And if I buy only Belkin, I'm sure I'll be fine. But we all know that's probably not going to be the reality.
Right. And then, you know, what happens when you want to connect something that Belkin hasn't, you know, created a device for yet? So you really want to try to pick your platform first and then pick things to meld with that platform.
Mm-hmm. And we mentioned SmartThings. What's another platform that's kind of on the come up right now?
There are a few open source, platforms. There's IoT Toolkit that's out there. And then a few of the kind of, boards that are out there. Spark has some pretty good boards, that allow different connectivity. Pretty much anything that's compatible with Arduino. Tesla, as we talked about a little bit earlier. So a few different ways to kind of create your own platform.
But from a consumer's perspective, it doesn't seem like IoT is quite there. Like, we're techies. We can go and buy boards and play at, you know, Spark Fun and buy stuff. But what about, you know, my non-technical dad? He's going to go, oh, Philips, they probably aren't good, and then think that he's fine.
Right. And this is something that, you know, we brought up during the talk, if you remember, how it's not, it's kind of just tipping his toe in the consumer space. So the typical consumer is not going to know to, you know, to look for a platform before looking for a device. They're not going to think in terms of platform. They're going to think, I want my alarm connected to my phone. You know, they're not going to think in terms of scalability, like most developers will start to think of. So in a lot of ways, it's not ready for prime time for the average consumer. But I think that, the techies, the early adopters can really start to push this and to create this, you know, what we'd like to see. That's the beautiful part of getting into something from the very beginning, is that you can start pushing it in the direction you'd like it to go.
Mm-hmm. You know, it makes me, the Internet of Things makes me think about, wasn't it called X1? It was that power. What was that called? Where you could control devices through your own, not through a network, because there was no Wi-Fi. We were doing it through the power connectors.
Yeah. I remember seeing something about that. Yep. I've never played with it though.
Yeah, I think I'm showing my age a little bit, but basically the idea was you'd have these remote power systems, and it was a quote unquote platform, but it was all based on the running over the power wires in your house. And but even though it was a standard, things wouldn't work together, so you'd have these unfortunate incompatibilities. Let's talk a little bit about some of the connections that these devices are using. I assume Wi-Fi is a big part of the Internet of Things.
Absolutely.
But what is Zigbee? I hear this word a lot, Zigbee.
So Zigbee is kind of a near communication type of connectivity. And it's not in widespread use. There were a few years ago, people thought that Zigbee might be the way to go. So there are a few devices that do have Zigbee connectivity, but it does seem to be that Bluetooth, especially BLE, is kind of winning that battle.
Bluetooth low energy.
Absolutely.
Okay. So you say it's like a near field. So it's not for hundreds and hundreds of feet away. This is for
absolutely small right. This networks. Is, and this is for devices that are close to each other. Okay. And, you know, a network that's pretty local.
Mm-hmm. And then there's another thing that's called Z-Wave, which is another wireless communications protocol. So it seems like you've got Z-Wave, you've got Zigbee, you've got Wi-Fi, and they're all at different frequency ranges. You know, some are in the gigahertz range like Wi-Fi, some are down around 900 megahertz. And each one is trying to be like the standard, and all we're ending up with is three standards.
Absolutely. But that's actually pretty good for us, right? We do want these to start standardizing. It's kind of hard to develop for NFC and Bluetooth and Wi-Fi and Zigbee. And so it's kind of nice that they're starting to narrow down the field a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I find really interesting about this, of course, if we look at like some of these non-Wi-Fi based, are what they call a mesh network. Mm-hmm. Because when I plugged in my first connected light bulb, it connected to my Wi-Fi. And then I'm like, oh, I'm going to have to give IP addresses to every freaking light bulb in the house. I thought that was kind of, that's kind of silly. But there's this thing called a mesh network. How does that work?
So with a mesh network, everything is acting as one. It's kind of like, working as one unit. So the network knows, or the mesh knows about its individual nodes, mm-hmm. but your network knows about the mesh.
Ah, okay. So I think about the collection of lights, and then the lights relay the data between each other.
Right, absolutely.
Okay, so it's almost kind of like an ad hoc network where as long as one of them's involved in my house, then another one can all jump in on the mesh.
Exactly.
Yeah, because I tell you, even with IPv6, I really don't want to have to think about all of the IP addresses of all the tiny devices in my house.
Yeah, I don't think any of us want to do that.
It seems like that is one of the, from a consumer perspective, the unspoken things about the Internet of Things that people don't realize is that you may have four or five IP devices in your house, your Xbox and your laptop and your phone. But then if you start putting in 15, 20, 50 different things, IP cams and sensors, this is going to flood your ability to manage stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, just flooding your Wi-Fi signal, you know, just flooding that. You have, you know, limited amounts of bandwidth, and, we hit it all the time. We have a pretty techie household. And so the more and more you connect, the more you're, you know, really taking out your Wi-Fi. So
yeah, I've got some IP cameras, and I had to make a separate Wi-Fi network for them because they're running all the time. And I kind of never thought about it, but that's taken a big fraction of what's going on around the house. And people love the drop cam because it's kind of like the Nest. It's this very simple to set up thing, but that's pushing high def video.
Absolutely.
Somehow. So some of the different things that one can get involved in from a developer side, let's switch to the developer side now, is you mentioned Arduino. What are some other boards that I could explore?
Well, we talked about the Spark.io is coming out. They're actually coming out with a new one that's a little cheaper, but still has a lot of the features of the old one. I think that's coming out first quarter of 2015.
Okay, and so Spark.io is a board I would buy.
Right. Well, it's actually kind of like a platform. And so they have their own board. And they have a new one coming out. There's one already out that you can buy. And I think you can buy that for about $40.
Right. And then there's the Spark Photon. So basically they're giving you the Wi-Fi connectivity for, I think, $20.
Right. So this is a faster, you know, board with more features for less than the current board.
Mm-hmm.
And that's coming out, first quarter of 2015.
Okay. And these kits, these are called dev kits, right? I would, basically build the connectivity I want. I don't buy one board that has like a laptop. It has Bluetooth and has Wi-Fi. When I get one of these boards, it has nothing basically, right?
Right. But they do have, again, the dev kits available so that you have everything you need for, you know, your purpose. They have a few for beginners so that you have a lot of the beginner modules that you would need to start building for IoT. And then they have some kind of more professional modules. mm-hmm. you can build from.
Some of these are really, really small, like the size of like an SD card. The Spark has got 2 megs of external flash, and it's about the size of your thumb.
Yeah, and the latest one, the Photon, as you mentioned, is even smaller than the current one. Another one that I like a lot is MetaWare has a board that has a lot of things just kind of built in. And it's also very small. Not quite as small as the Photon, but very small.
Mm-hmm. And that the MetaWare platform has an open API for Android and for iOS. And a lot of these devices use ARM as their mm-hmm. processor of choice for, I assume, power reasons?
Yes, I believe that's the case.
So some of these dev platforms come with lots of different sensors, like accelerometers and temperature sensors. What are some other sensors I might plug into something like this?
So you might have a gyroscope, you might have a magnetometer, something for pressure and altitude. And then there's something called a sensor fusion chip, which will have a lot of the sensors kind of built in.
Ah, interesting. I've saw at SparkFun where I can buy sensors kind of onesie-twosie, you know, for $15-$20. But it seems like even those are getting made smaller and smaller and smaller.
Absolutely. And the benefit of, say, a sensor fusion chip is that you have this smaller chip that can connect to a lot of different sensors, and it makes your device, you know, less clumsy, you know.
So when I take a dev kit like this, it's sometimes is a little MacGyver-esque, you know, the resulting solution, right? It ends up being a bunch of things wired together on a breadboard. How do I take that from prototype stage into something I'd actually, you know, produce?
So once you're moving past the prototype stage, you're probably going to want to build these things into the board. So you're not going to be kind of plug and play. As we were talking about before, you're going to want to create a board that has, you know, whatever sensors you need, that has the built-in accelerometer, pressure altitude sensor inside the board versus, you know, putting them all together kind of, ad hoc.
So it seems like for the hobbyist, that's probably beyond a lot of people's expertise. It certainly sounds beyond mine. Like I can intellectualize what you're saying, and I could say I wish that I had a board that had these three sensors on it, but I would probably not be able to do that myself.
Well, at that point, you really want to start looking into manufacturing is what you want to do. And so you're going to want to find, you know, your electrician, you know, the people who understand the electrical engineering behind all of this stuff. And so at that point, you're going to want to start getting more people involved, and start building that kind of from scratch.
I see. So as a non-hardware person, I could prototype this stuff. I could show it to someone who knows more about hardware and say, look, I've made the most amazing thing that will water plants automatically. And then we would take, I built it on the blank platform, the MetaWare platform, the Arduino platform, the whatever platform. And then now we go and take it from prototype a little bit farther.
Right. And then you start kind of blueprinting it together with your electrical engineer to come up with something that, you know, is kind of all in one.
Mm-hmm. So we talked about how some of them use ARM and these different processors. Am I writing C for most of these applications, or can I write higher level languages?
In some of them, you can. Most of them start with a C-like language, and then there are different ways to incorporate, you know, very high level languages like JavaScript, and then also, you know, your mobile languages, so, you know, Java and stuff for Android. So there are different ways to kind of build on the natural language, which is in most cases very C-like, and to get more functionality by using some of these higher level languages.
It seems like I said before, that there's the hobbyist level of complexity, which I don't think I necessarily want to be teaching my kids C kind of at this level. They're too young. But the barrier to entry kind of hits right there at C and electrical engineering. I saw that the Tessel, TESSEL.io, uses JavaScript.
Right. That's based on Node.js. So that's something that's a lot less intimidating for the hobbyist or for somebody who's kind of new to, you know, to development, especially for hardware. A lot of us are either software developers or we're hardware. So the Tessel is really cool that it kind of abstracts a lot of that stuff so that if you're, you know, typically a software person, that you can get started right away.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose that even theoretically that would be a prototyping. I mean, I guess I could go live with a Tessel, but I could also prototype it, give it to someone else, and they might make a tiny board and do it all in C again for me.
Right, right.
I'm looking at the list of modules that it has just to get people thinking about what they could do. reading RFID cards, like badging in to work, controlling servos on remote controlled cars, keypads, motion detectors. I think sometimes it's so overwhelming, people don't even realize how much they could do with the Internet of Things.
Absolutely. I mean, at this point, you can create a sensor for just about everything, or use a sensor for just about everything. Anything that you want to monitor, there's something out there for it.
Yeah, I'm even looking here. There's a pulse sensor where someone could look at your fingertip and fire an event on every heartbeat.
Absolutely. And we're seeing that, come about in more wearables where you have the continuous pulse monitoring. So, I mean, it's something that we're starting to see in the consumer space as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we met at All Things Open, I think I talked to you briefly about the fact that I was a diabetic and that I'm interested in connecting my different diabetes devices. Recently, I went to a diabetes tech event, and I was told by someone who worked for IEEE that they're actually working on Bluetooth profiles for medical devices like my insulin pump and like my continuous glucose meter.
Oh, that is awesome.
So that could be the Internet of Things too, right? I mean, I can plug that into anything.
Oh, it definitely is. It definitely is. I mean, really, the Internet of Things is about monitoring your environment and your world. And so you have to find those things that you care about monitoring on a regular basis. And how can you use that information to make it, you know, useful to you? That's what it's all about.
Yeah, I'm thinking, I just literally had this idea that, let's say that you're maybe deaf and you have diabetes and you want to flash the lights in your house when your blood sugar goes low. I mean, like, that's the level at which we're talking about. You have an infinite number of things that you could potentially plug into.
Absolutely.
So talk to me a little bit about Arduino, because it feels like Arduino kicked a lot of this stuff off from the maker perspective, like you pointed out at the beginning. There's a thing called an Arduino Shield. Is this like a standard for plugging stuff into other stuff?
Yeah, so this is pretty standard for Arduino boards, is that you have a shield that will allow you to add different modules, to add different sensors, so that you're capturing some of these events that you can actually, you know, create triggers for, as you just explained with the pulse monitoring.
And is this notion of a shield, this is like a hardware, what they call a PCB, right, that plugs on top of stuff, but it seems like it's not necessarily specific to Arduino, because competing platforms say, hey, we'll use a shield. We're not Arduino, but we can use those devices.
Oh, absolutely. And most of the boards out there are creating modules and shields that are compatible with Arduino, because Arduino was kind of the first to start this whole maker movement with the Internet of Things.
Mm. And the shields, whether it be sensors or what Arduino called shields, they've got things like weather, even ones that'll do like MP3 players, really anything. Is there a particular shield that is your most favorite or most fun?
I'm working with a few different things. Well, actually, currently I'm working with MetaWare, and we'll be moving soon to Spark, the Photon. Mm-hmm. But I like controlling things around my house. I like controlling the lights, those kind of things. So just understanding, you know, ambient light and sound kind of things, climate, or, you know, those kind of sensors are the ones I use most.
My kids were impressed with one that flashed the lights like a disco based on the sound of the music that was playing on an MP3 player.
I just went to a workshop where a guy was showing that, and it was pretty cool.
What lights, what consumer-based Internet of Things products do you have in your house?
Working with smart things and trying to see how I can extend that. I haven't come up with any really cool extensions yet, but really like smart things right now.
Mm-hmm. Did you buy any of the Philips Hue light bulbs? I bought some that were called LIFX, Light FX.
No, I haven't experimented with the Philips light bulbs.
One of the things that I've been worried about is security, and it's come up with me with light bulbs, where the light bulb might save the password for my Wi-Fi in an insecure way. And again, as a consumer, I don't know this.
Right.
And there was a time there for a couple of weeks where there was a bug in the particular light bulb that I had, where someone could basically leap into the mesh network and then hop a second hop into my Wi-Fi. Does that mean my refrigerator and my IoT is now an entry point into my house? You're going to take all my stuff?
In some ways, yes. I mean, I hate to say that, but I think in a lot of cases, we have kind of run full speed with Internet of Things without taking security into consideration. And so this is something that we need to be thinking about from the moment we start working with our prototypes, from the moment we start working with our boards and start coding. So if you do that, you won't have a situation where you have, you know, your password stored in plain text. I mean, if you had thought about that before, I mean, and not you, but if the developer or, you know, the person who's creating these devices, if they would think about these things before, you wouldn't have to just kind of throw in, you know, plain text passwords. So I think that that's the kind of next step, and it needs to be, you know, right now, honestly, that we need to start taking a look at. Like, this is going to pretty much push out so much data about individuals. How are you going to protect that individual? How are you going to make that, you know, information anonymous so that we can't target certain individuals? You know, we really need to start thinking about security before we go much further with the features and the capabilities of the Internet of Things.
Yeah, and it seems also like there's security from a InfoSec perspective, in the sense of, is my house secure? Is someone going to be able to sit in the car, you know, an NSA van in the front of my house and break in? There's that level of security. But there's also, like you alluded to a little bit there, is like personal security, like whether or not someone could find out if I'm home or not by looking Absolutely. At my things. Or is Facebook going to start collecting information on how I use lighting, and then I'm going to get some creepy advertisement, you know, hey, it looks like you like cool lighting.
You probably will.
So it seems like the consumer data is engaged in this as well.
Absolutely. And so we have to find different ways, you know, looking at, you mentioned Facebook, what a lot of people don't realize is that there's a way to control how Facebook uses your data. Now, you're limited because, you know,
sure,
look at their terms and conditions, but there are ways to protect yourself. And so as consumers, we have to be more aware of our information, the information that's out there about us, but how we can protect it.
Well, and all of these things are in the EULAs, right? The user and user license agreements. But, you know, I realized that I've been logging into like my alarm.com or my Nest using different logins and not really thinking about, well, gosh, that used OAuth, and now there's a relationship between these two companies. Like I just pointed out at the very beginning, I talked about if this, then that.
Absolutely. And
I'm like, well, they can log into my Nest now. I didn't even really think about plugging those social logins to each other. And I don't know how, if I can't understand it and you can barely understand it, how do we explain that to our parents?
That's a very good point. We need to start working through this now and creating standards around this now so that we can start explaining it to the average consumer.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, updates have been a huge problem. While my Nest has been truly one of the most polished devices I've ever owned, it updates itself automatically, I've had to flash the firmware on my light bulbs 3 different times in the last year. It's not fun.
I imagine it isn't. So that's very interesting that you have, you know, this mesh that's connected to your Wi-Fi, and we can't find a way to update this over, you know, over your wireless connection.
Well, it seems like it wasn't in the case of my particular brand of light bulbs. It wasn't really their priority, right? Mm-hmm. I had to actually download an app and, of course, know that I needed to, then run the app on my Windows machine. And then literally it was like, don't touch your light bulbs. So my wife is like, why are the lights on at 2 a.m. here? Well, I'm flashing them. Well, I'm going to turn them off. Don't turn them off. They're flashing. Like, that's not okay. I mean, my non-technical people shouldn't have to think about that.
And that kind of goes back to what we were talking about with security. You have to think about these things. You have to think about your user from the very beginning. I mean, that's anything that you're doing, whether you're doing web development, whether you're doing mobile development, you should be thinking about, how can you make life easier for your user? And so that's one of those situations where they maybe didn't take the user into consideration.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that that's been a passion of yours as well. I mean, you have an understanding about the user experience as it relates to the hardware development that you do, and making sure that you keep the user thinking first.
Right. And there was something that I learned from, I think it was a Google Glass workshop, and something that I've taken with me when I do a lot of the prototyping, or when I work on anything really. And it's developed for the user, not for the technology. As developers, a lot of times we can, you know, we want to see how far we can push things. We want to see, you know, what's the latest cool feature that we can make use of immediately. And if that's not, if you can't do that in a way where it, you know, makes things easier, for the user and delights your user, then maybe we shouldn't be doing them.
Yeah. I keep coming back to the Nest because I feel like today that's the example. Like that's the pinnacle. I walked past my Nest yesterday and noticed that it had updated itself and it told me the weather outside. And it didn't do that a year ago when I turned the thing on. So like a new feature showed up and I was delighted.
Exactly. You should always, if you're going to surprise your user, it should be in a way that delights them. It should not be in a way that's like, what? I have to flash this every three, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday I was at Intel giving a talk and I was kind, a gentleman was kind enough to give me an Intel Edison.
Which is very cool.
Intel processor. And I could actually, it's running Linux. I could remote into this thing. I can SSH into it and I can run top. That really brings to mind a question about, at what level do I want to operate? Do I want a fully featured computer, which this is, or do I want something that's like an Arduino, which is really a single use device?
And I think that really, it really, determine, you have to determine what you need this particular device to do. How connected do you need this device to be? How powerful do you need this device to be? Because if you don't need some of the power that you might get from an Edison, you may want to move to something that's smaller, and only tracks the things that you need it to track. But if you're building, you know, say something that's going to be like a media device or, you know, something that's going to require more power, that's going to be using, say, displays, certain, you know, if you need that, then you may want to move to something like the Edison.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like the Edison has definitely got the power to do something like run a tiny touch display. I could use it for, my own custom touch panel. While I see Arduinos doing more like LED. What are those called? The LEDs that are like the stock ticker type of a thing. But I wouldn't necessarily want to run a full screen on the thing.
Yeah, you'll start to kind of buzz it. So I don't think you'd want to do that.
So where do you recommend that people who are listening to get started? They just go Arduino and do that, or should they go with your favorite? What was your favorite?
Lately I've been using Metaware. Which has a bit of a learning curve. So if you're not already a mobile developer, you would have to kind of get familiar with either, you know, iOS or Android development. Mm-hmm. But there are a few things out there. I mean, you know, we talked about Spark Core, having the Photon out there. There are a few different, devices, Arduinos, Edison, but a lot of these require, like you said, C-like languages. So if you're not familiar with developing at a low level, you may want to start there. You may want to start with kind of familiarizing yourself with low-level type development.
I want to make sure that people know that Spark, the Spark Photon, the one that you were talking about, that Spark.io is different from Spark Fun, which is an electronics company where you can buy these things.
Right,
so
right.
That might take a second to understand.
Right. I believe that Spark.io is built on the Spark Core platform versus, like you said, Spark Fun being
which is a store. And you can buy a lot of great stuff. The thing that I like about Spark Fun for getting started is that you can buy bundles and save money.
Very cool stuff there.
Yeah, yeah. And putting together, I've been putting together robots with my kids, and they have enjoyed that very much. And I know that Rockbot, who we had on the show a while back, is a big fan of using Node as the as an introductory language. So the TESOL is an extremely friendly place to start for those who aren't necessarily into C.
Right. And this really gets to something that I mentioned at the talk is choose your hardware first. Choose your hardware based on what you know, what you're comfortable with. And that's going to influence a lot of your software decisions. So if you're already familiar with JavaScript and Node, then the TESOL is, you know, the natural choice.
And the thing I like about the TESOL is that it has Wi-Fi built in. Do you think that's important to stick with as a beginner to start with Wi-Fi rather than going into Bluetooth or Zigbee?
I do, because we're pretty familiar with Wi-Fi. There's not a whole lot of custom coding we're going to have to do to connect certain things with Wi-Fi. There's a lot of handshaking that goes on with Bluetooth. You're definitely going to want to get involved in that, but this is kind of, you know, a soft introduction to the connectivity.
Right. Absolutely. And everyone agrees that this is going to be big. Like it is a buzzword and it's certainly the buzzword that we're all excited about, but they're saying that connected stuff is going to be like the biggest thing ever. It's the biggest thing since the internet.
Right. It's going to be the new internet, pretty much.
If we're going to make a Skynet and the Terminators are going to come and kill us all, they will probably start with IoT. They're saying it's going to be like, you know, multi-billion dollar industry in the next 5 years. So a good time to jump in and learn how to make this stuff.
Absolutely. We want to kind of be ahead of the curve there.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much, Erica Stanley, for talking to me about the Internet of Things.
Thank you.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.